Thank you, Mr. Pavlik, and good afternoon, everyone. That little bobble at the beginning of services is not embarrassing. Not at all. You know what's embarrassing? And now for the first split sermon, Mr. Hal Henderson. I have a split sermon today? That's embarrassing. Fortunately, that's never happened. But I'm prepared in case it does. We're getting close to Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread, and there are so many vivid themes associated with those spring holy days. We're going to jump right into the Bible for one of those themes. If you'll turn with me to Exodus chapter 14, we're going to begin reading in verse 9. Exodus 14, beginning in verse 9. Now, Egypt is in pursuit of Israel. Verse 9, so the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea, beside Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us out to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better to have served the Egyptians than that we die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more forever. And the Eternal will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And at that point, God gives Moses some instructions as to what he is to do next. And we're going to drop down to verse 17. And I will indeed harden the heart of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. And we know, he's saying, he will follow them into the sea. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood between them, or behind them. So this pillar of cloud that had been leading Israel now moves behind them to separate them from the pursuing Egyptians. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, that would be the Egyptian side, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Eternal caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them in the midst of the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And we know what happened next. We'll pick it up in verse 28. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Eternal had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Eternal and believed the Eternal and his servant Moses. God's intervention for Israel was miraculous. It was visible. It was very, very open. And it followed 10 miraculous interventions in the land of Egypt. We refer to them as the 10 plagues. Mr. Patchinger mentioned Jeremy Lawler's Sabbath blog. Guess what? His Sabbath blog from January of 2016, titled "The God of the Impossible," highlights that our God, the God we worship, is not limited by the laws of physics, by the laws of nature, and he's not constrained by our concepts of what we think is possible. He is the God of the impossible. We won't turn there, but in Genesis chapter 18 and verse 14, he gives a rhetorical question to Abraham. Is anything too hard for the eternal? The obvious answer is no. Now maybe, just maybe, some of us here have personally witnessed God intervening for us or others at a critical moment in a strikingly visible way where he suspends the laws of nature. Maybe not quite as dramatic as the cloud, the pillar of cloud. Maybe not quite as dramatic as parting the Red Sea, but something close. If you've experienced that, share that with your brothers and sisters in conversation, because those are profoundly important events and inspiring events to all of us. But sometimes, instead of these open, overt miracles, God works in a slightly different way. He works in a hidden manner by subtly influencing countless events with precise timing to bring about his purpose. And I dare say all of us in this room have experienced this unseen hand of God in our lives at one time or another. The title of today's message is "The Seen and Unseen Hand of God." The Seen and Unseen Hand of God. We started off with an example of the seen hand of God. Very visible. The miracles of Egypt. The miracles of the Red Sea. The parting of the Red Sea. Let's look at some examples of the unseen hand of God. All familiar stories from the Bible. We'll begin by looking at the story of Joseph. Now, this may sound slightly familiar, and as well it should, because on February 10, 2018, Mr. Johnson gave a sermon that largely focused on Joseph and his example. But there's always things we can tease out of these biblical stories from a different angle that helps expand our knowledge and understanding. So let's go to Genesis chapter 37. Starting in verse 1, Genesis 37, 1. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph being 17 years old, he's a kid, was feeding the flocks with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Okay, a little bit of tattling going on, so there's a little bit of dissension you can see beginning to build within the family. And it gets worse. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him. And they could not speak peaceably to him. So, we've got this family tension. And then we know that Joseph has a dream. Verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers. And they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear the dream." Wisdom might have said, keep this one to yourself, but Joseph had not yet acquired the wisdom that he would eventually come to have. "Please hear this dream which I've dreamed." He's thinking, this is so amazing, you've got to hear this. "There we were, binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said to him, "Wasn't that cute?" No. They said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. More family tension. And then Joseph has another dream. Verse 9. And he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream." He didn't learn his lesson the first time. "And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down before you, to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So he's got some family issues here going on, and we know what happens next. He's sent out into the field by his father to find how things are going with his brothers who are minding the flocks. So we're going to go to verse 18. Because Joseph, on his way to locate his brothers, "Now when they saw him far off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him." I know in most of our families, we've probably been, if you've got siblings, you may have been angry enough at one time or another that you, before conversion, would blurt out, "I'm going to kill you for that." But we really didn't mean it. We were angry. They meant it. They conspired against him to kill him. And they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him, and we'll cast him into some pit, and we'll say some wild animal has devoured him. We'll see what becomes of his dreams." So, things are not going all that well. But someone had a mercenary idea and said, why kill him? Let's make some money off of him. Verse 26. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come now, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh." And his brothers listened. So the Midianite traders came, passed by. The brothers pulled Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So here he's gone from favored, pampered son of the family, most prized by his father, detested by his brothers, but generally left alone, other than they couldn't speak peaceably to him. And now he's just been rescued from being murdered, and he's on his way as a slave. He's been sold by his brothers, and he's on his way to Egypt. Now we know from the rest of the story, which we don't have time to cover in all the detail, that he wound up in the house of Potiphar, an officer, the captain of the guard. And he flourished in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar gave him basically all of the privileges, because everything Joseph did turned out well. And Potiphar prospered because of what Joseph was doing for the household. And things were going really, really, really well until he gets falsely accused of attempted rape or sexual assault, depending on your particular view of the charges. And we will see, picking it up now in chapter 39 in verse 16. Potiphar's wife accuses Joseph of attempting to rape her, basically to cover up that Joseph refused to be seduced by her and had to leave the house in an embarrassing situation. So to deflect any blame from her, she points the finger at Joseph. So Joseph flees, leaving a garment behind. Verse 16, so she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened as I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment with me and fled outside. So it was, when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. So he's gone from pampered son to slave, to prosperous slave, to jailbird on false charges. Things are, if you're looking at Joseph's life at this point, you're thinking, what is going on? What have I done wrong? Why am I being treated this way? Why is God allowing this to happen? We recall that while Joseph's in prison, Pharaoh's butler and baker are also in prison, and they each had dreams. And Joseph was given the ability by God to interpret dreams. And Joseph interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker. And we're going to pick it up in chapter 40, verse 13, as he's interpreted the dream of the butler. And he tells the butler things are going to be okay. Now, within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you. And please, show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed, I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I've done nothing here that they should put me in the dungeon. When the chief baker... is basically where we're going to break right there. He says, when you get out, when Pharaoh restores you as this dream says he will, remember me, help me, show me kindness. Now down to verse 23. We'll pick up the story. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Continuing reading in chapter 41. Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And we'll just end there. Because the point is, Joseph is wrongfully imprisoned. He's helped someone get out of prison, basically. Asked for help, was ignored. 2 more years in prison on a false charge. Then we know that Joseph is able to interpret Pharaoh's dream. It's revealed by God to him. And the dream is about 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. We have to compress the story to get to the ultimate point. And Pharaoh wonders, well, how are we going to deal with this? Joseph wisely says, use those 7 years to store up grain. Pile up food and prepare for the 7 years of famine, and you'll make it through. Pharaoh puts Joseph in charge of that because who else would be so wise as to see this coming and know how to deal with it? And under Joseph's hand, Egypt prospered. They did manage to get 7 years of grain stored away, prepared for the famine. And indeed, the famine came. And it wasn't just a famine in Egypt. It was a famine throughout the entire region. And Joseph's family, back in the land of Canaan, suffered from the famine as well. Things got so bad that their father had to send the sons to Egypt to buy grain. And we know that they had to come twice, and they did not recognize Joseph, who by now is basically the second in command of Egypt. Joseph didn't let them know who he was. They didn't recognize him because they surely didn't expect that this kid that they sold as a slave is almost is the second ruler of Egypt. And we know that Joseph sent them back with grain, but he kept someone back and he required that they bring the younger brother Benjamin and come back. And they didn't want to do it. But the famine stretched on and on and on, and they had to eventually come back to buy more grain the second time, because otherwise they were going to starve. Now, we're going to pick it up in chapter 45, where the brothers are back the second time, and they've really been kind of, Joseph's kind of playing with them. He's being hard on them. They're a little bit afraid of him, and they should be, because the second in command of Egypt not only has the right to give or deny grain that they need, but he could imprison them and he could kill them. But Joseph eventually has to break the ice, and he does it in verse 45. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him with his brothers around, and he cried out, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Then he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" But his brothers couldn't answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. They were shocked. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come near to me." So they came near. Then he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine have been in the land, and there are still 5 more years where there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So no, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and Lord to all of his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." Joseph saw that all of the bad things that had happened to him were actually God's unseen hand orchestrating a series of events that took him from the land of Canaan out into the field, into a hole in the ground, to be sold by the Amalekites, to be taken to Egypt, to be sold to Potiphar, to prosper in Potiphar's house, to be thrown into jail on a false charge, to stay there for years, and eventually to be raised up, because God had a purpose. And God's unseen hand orchestrated those events to bring all of that to pass. Let's continue in reading. We finished in verse 8. Continue in verse 9. Joseph speaking to his brothers, "Hurry and go to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and do not tarry. You will dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children, your children's children, your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and of all that you have seen, and you shall hurry and bring my father down here.' Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And after that, his brothers talked with him." Remember, these were the brothers who hated him, who could not speak peaceably to him. God's unseen hand not only preserved their lives, but he restored a broken family, all by the unseen hand of God. Let's look at another example of the unseen hand of God in action. Familiar story of David. And if this sounds familiar again, it might be because on January 27, 2018, Mr. Britton Taylor gave a sermon about 5 smooth stones. And do you need them all? David was one of the central characters of that sermon. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to jump right into the middle of a story to get some background of what we're going to read about David. We're going to go to 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel 17. We're going to read verses 34 and 35. You'll get the context later, so bear with me. But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it." We'll begin the first section of verse 36. "Your servant has killed both lion and bear." Now remember, David is a young man at this stage. It's not quite clear what age he was, possibly still a teenager, maybe really early 20s, hard to tell. But with this little bit of background, think how David could have looked at his life. Here I am, I'm a kid. I'm out in the field. All I got around me are these sheep, trying to mind my own business, doing what my father sent me to do, and I'm attacked by a lion and a bear. What an unlucky kid. Who asked for this? I just wanted to tend the sheep. I got to fight a bear? I got to fight a lion? This is a horrible life. He could have looked at it that way. Now we're going to back up a bit. Still in chapter 17. We're going to back up and get a little more of the story and see where those early events in David's life play out. Begin in verse 1. "Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Sokoh, which belongs to Judah, and they encamped between Sokoh and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. Then the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span." All right, now a cubit was generally viewed as about from the elbow to the fingers of a man. So there were two different measures that were used. One was a royal cubit and another one was a different common cubit. But you're looking at something close to about a foot and a half. All right, do the math. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a mathematician. 6 cubits times a foot and a half. And how big is this guy? He could be about 9 feet tall. This is a monster of a man. Verse 10. "And the Philistine said, 'I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.' When Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons. And the man was old and advanced in years in the days of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of the 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and night." So this taunting was going on daily. "Then Jesse said to his son David, 'Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000 and see how your brothers fare and bring back news of them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, took the things, and went as Jesse had commanded him. And as he came to the camp, as the army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle, for Israel and Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army, and David left his supplies in the hands of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. There he talked with them. There was the Philistine, or then as he talked with him, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words. So David heard this. David's now hearing this taunt. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches, will give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. Such a deal I have for you." Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away this reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, saying, "Well, so it shall be done to the man who kills him." We've seen a little problem with families as we talked about Joseph. It's kind of common. Verse 28, now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. So he's hearing David talking to the other soldiers. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David and said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? Here we are trying to fight a big army and you just got a handful of sheep. What are you doing here? I know your pride and your insolence, or the insolence of your heart, for you've just come down to watch the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" He said, "Come on, give it a rest, brother." Then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first one did. Now when the words which David spoke were heard, and they were reported them to Saul, he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight him, for you're a kid, you're a youth, and he's a man of war from his youth." But David said to Saul, this sounds familiar. "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Eternal, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Eternal be with you." The poor kid whose life as a teenager seemed to be, why me? Why am I supposed to be quietly tending the sheep and have to deal with lion attack and bear attack? He now sees God's unseen hand was giving him the training, the strength, the courage that he needed to help deliver Israel from their oppressors. God's unseen hand was doing all of this because somebody needed the strength to face Goliath. God was working behind the scenes to mold David into the young man that he needed for that time for the nation. And the interesting thing about it, it's a bit of an aside, but here in chapter 17, Saul has already been rejected by God as king. David was already anointed by Samuel to be a future king, but he's still willing to be a servant. He's still willing to be brave and do what has to be done for the benefit of the nation. All because of God's unseen hand earlier in his life, bringing him to the point where he was equipped and trained and able to take on this massive role. There's a third category of God's intervention. We've already seen multiple examples in the Exodus from Egypt of God's seen hand, his miraculous intervention. We've looked at two examples of God's unseen hand intervening to accomplish his purpose. There's a third category. Sometimes God's intervening hand is seen by some and not seen by others. It's kind of a combination. Some see it, some don't see it. The example from the Bible is Elisha and his servant. Familiar story. Go with me, if you would, to 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings 6. We'll begin reading in verse 8. This is quite an interesting story as well. Now, the king of Syria was making war against Israel. So, in a historical context, this is post-Solomon's death. The nations are split with Judah in the south, Israel in the north. Israel is still a nation. But now we've got Syria, which is to the northeast of Israel, at war with Israel. And he, meaning the king of Syria, consulted with his servants, saying, "My camp will be in such and such a place." So he's making his battle plans. Here's where we're going to go. And the man of God, meaning Elisha, sent to the king of Israel, saying, "Beware that you do not pass by this place, for the Syrians are coming down there." So he's basically telling the king of Israel, avoid this area up here because that's where the king of Syria is going to be. That's dangerous. You need to avoid that area. Then the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, and he was watchful there, not just once or twice. So we've got a series of Syrian army movements trying to lure Israel into a trap, and Israel is escaping the trap, never taking the bait, because Elisha is telling the king of Israel where to avoid the bait and the trap. "Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, 'Will you not show me which one of us is for the king of Israel?'" He said, "We got a spy. There's a spy in our midst. That's the only way that guy is able to avoid my traps." Verse 12. And one of his servants said, "None, my lord. It ain't us. It ain't us. But Elisha, the prophet who's in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." He said, "I don't know how he does it, but somehow this man in Israel knows your secret plans as you're planning them. And he's the one who's warning the king of Israel to avoid a trap." So he, that would be the king of Syria, said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and get him." This Elijah is the one causing the trouble. Let's go get him. And it was told him, saying, "Surely he's in Dothan." "Therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city." And they weren't there on a social visit. They were there to arrest Elisha and take him away. "And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him," probably what you or I would have said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" So he answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." I picture this servant scratching his head saying, okay, now the boss has really lost it because I only see the army. And Elisha prayed and said, Eternal, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Then the Eternal opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. There was a heavenly army present to protect Elisha from the army of the Syrians. And the servant didn't know it, nor did the Syrians know it. Verse 18, so that when the Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Eternal, said, strike this people, I pray, with blindness. And it happened. Here's another example of God's intervention. Unseen by some, unseen by the Syrian army, unseen by the servant of Elijah, seen by Elijah, and Elisha, with his prayer, was able to open the eyes of his servant so that he could see God's intervening hand, his angelic army that was there to protect. So that's an example of God's intervening hand being seen by some and not being seen by others. Okay, these are biblical examples, but that was, I don't know about you, this was a long time ago. Been a long time since, you would think, since some of that has happened. The events surrounding Joseph that we talked about, around 3,900 years ago. The events with David, about 3,050 years ago. The events with Elisha, about 2,850 years ago. Not exactly recently. Has God stopped doing this sort of thing? Is this just for the Bible? Is God's hand shortened? Might there be an example of something more modern? How about, let's say, 1973? Many of you were walking the planet in 1973. Some of you were not. How about October of 1973? I was a young Coast Guard lieutenant. I had just finished 3 years of sea duty. I'd been sent by the Coast Guard to Cleveland, Ohio, where I had never set foot before in my life, to attend law school. And in October of 1973, I was attending Cleveland Marshall College of Law, Cleveland State University, going to law school. I remember the time that I'm about to share with you. I'm going to be reading a section from a book called Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence by Hebrew writer Nehemiah Gordon. During the 1973 Yom Kippur War, Israel experienced a modern-day act of God's protection. To this day, it's still a matter of dispute among the faithful whether this was God lifting his face through an overt miracle or hiding his face and influencing events from behind the scenes. The miracle took place on the Golan Heights, a historical part of the land of Israel that extends across a 20-mile-wide barren plateau. During 19 years of Syrian occupation, the Jewish towns of the Jordan Valley and western Galilee were terrorized by Syrian gunners high up on the western edge of the Golan, firing indiscriminately into civilian targets. This only ended after Israel liberated the Golan Heights in the 1967 Six-Day War. Then, on October 6, 1973, the Syrians launched an unprovoked surprise attack, storming into the Golan with a force of 1,400 tanks. They knew Israel relied on a citizens' army made up of reservists, so they coordinated their attack with Egypt for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Egypt struck through the Sinai to the southwest of Israel. The Syrians came in from the northeast. Most reserve soldiers were in the synagogues, weak from fasting and far from the front. Israel's standing army had only 177 tanks deployed on the Golan at the start of the war. Remember, 1,400 Syrian tanks poured through in a day. The Israeli forward defense lines quickly collapsed along most of the border. By the second day of the war, Syrian units had penetrated to within a few miles of the strategic bridges over the Jordan River. From there, all of Israel lay before them, virtually undefended. The Syrians could have battled across the Jordan and put an end to the Jewish state. Instead, a miracle happened. Simon Dunstan, a military historian who wrote one of the definitive books on the war, explains. With their leading units within sight of the Sea of Galilee, following their overwhelming triumph on the southern Golan, the Syrians inexplicably halted their offensive, and the momentum was lost, never to be regained. No one knows for sure why the Syrians stopped. The author says, "When I heard about this miracle, I began to devour a series of books on the battles that raged on the Golan Heights during the war. I learned that the Syrians struck across the border in a three-pronged attack, which was initially successful in the central and the southern Golan, but was held up in the north. All the books I read agreed that the Syrians should have poured their forces into the central and southern districts, seizing the bridges over the Jordan River before Israel had a chance to mobilize. Instead, the central and southern prongs of the attack seemed to be waiting for the northern prong to catch up. The northern prong, for its part, got bogged down in one of the fiercest tank battles in history, in a place that would come to be known as the Valley of Tears. I remembered a story from the book, The Heights of Courage, by Avigdor Kahalani, the Israeli tank commander in charge of the 77th Battalion in the north of Syria, or the north of Israel. The Syrians must have thought that driving only 3 miles through the 2-mile-wide valley would be easy. They had 500 tanks and hundreds of other armored fighting vehicles. On the northern Golan alone, the Israelis were outnumbered 15-1 at the start of the battle. They deployed along the line of hills, a series of volcanic cones overlooking the Valley of Tears, and they began to open fire on the relentless Syrian onslaught. In his book, Kahalani describes how his men were dying to his left and his right as the Syrians pressed forward for 4 grueling days. He knew he had to continue the fight because of the existential nature of this war. If the Syrians lost, they'd be humiliated. If Israel lost, it would cease to exist. As one Israeli tank commander would later explain, they were fighting to stop the second Holocaust. Despite the huge imbalance of numbers, Kahalani's small and desperate force managed to inflict staggering losses on the Syrians. By the end of the fourth day, they destroyed some 260 Syrian tanks, along with hundreds of armored personnel carriers and other enemy vehicles. The series of events that led to this victory rivals anything in the life of Joseph or Esther. Perhaps the single most miraculous event was the arrival of vital reinforcements at a moment when Kahalani was down to only 7 tanks, almost out of ammunition and fuel, and had lost control of the line of hills that dominated the Valley of Tears. The reinforcements were headed by Yossi ben Hanan, a tank commander who was a reservist, was not even in the active army at the time, who was on his honeymoon in Nepal. That That's north of India, folks, at the Himalayas, on his honeymoon in Nepal when the war broke out. He managed to take a series of flights through Tehran and Athens to get back and defend Israel. His family was waiting for him at the airport with his uniform. He immediately drove to the northern front, where he managed to cobble together a force of 13 tanks. Damaged in earlier fighting, but now patched together, barely battle-worthy. He then scraped together ad hoc tank crews made up of reservists and wounded soldiers who had escaped from the hospital in order to return to the fight. Ben Kanan's hodgepodge force seized the line of hills overlooking the Valley of Tears just as Kahalani fired his last rounds at the Syrians. Bear with me. This story chokes me up when I read it. Not long thereafter, the Syrians began to retreat. So why did the Syrians retreat? After the war, Kahalani's commander, Yunush bin Gal, offered his view. The Syrians apparently assumed they had no chance of success. They did not know the truth, that our situation was desperate. Anyone who thinks that the Syrians were cowards, that ran at the first sign of trouble, should read Kahalani's book. The Syrians were still coming, Kahalani writes, and the fact that the damage we did to their comrades didn't stop them was worrying me. Could they be that brave? Hard to believe. This was the second day of the invasion, and the Syrians continued to try breaking through the Valley of Tears for two more days. The Syrian determination and bravery was impressive, but not as impressive as the Israeli audacity to stand against a force 15 times their size. What gave Kahalani and his men the resolve to hold the Syrians back through nearly 80 grueling hours of battle? What gave Ben Kanan the chutzpah to show up with 13 damaged tanks manned by wounded soldiers to stand up to the Syrian bullets? Many Israelis insist this was nothing less than God lifting his face towards Israel, performing an overt miracle to save his people from annihilation. The Israeli documentary, it's a movie, Zero Hour, which I would love to see, except for the fact that it's in Hebrew, describes this miracle in the words of a captured Syrian soldier interrogated by Israeli intelligence after the war. According to the documentary, the intelligence officer asked the Syrian, "What is the reason you stopped on the line of hills on the Golan Heights? Because remember, they had massive, overwhelming force. They had the possibility of breaking through, but they stopped." According to the documentary, the Syrian responded, "I would like to see you cross the Syrian line of hills when you see a whole row of white angels standing above a line of hills and a white hand from the heavens signaling you to stop." I stopped. This is not biblical. This is from a secular source, so I can't absolutely vouch for it with the same confidence that I can from the Bible. But it was a miracle. Historically, it was a miracle. And notice the parallel that the unseen hand of God was there. Some didn't see it. One important Syrian commander saw the hand of God. Notice the parallel. On a different mountain in northern Israel, with Elisha and his servant. So does God still have the ability to intervene for us? The point of all this is that the God we serve is capable of doing things which seem impossible. He can do it in very visible, unmistakable ways, like the parting of the Red Sea, or he can orchestrate events in a very subtle way with an unseen hand, sort of like what happened with Joseph, with David, but to accomplish his purpose. Sometimes he acts in a way that is seen by some and unseen by others. I'm going to close by going to one last scripture, Isaiah 55, verses 10 through 11. Isaiah 55, 10 through 11. For as the rain comes down, and the snow from heaven, and do not return there, but water the earth, and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower, and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. The Complete Jewish Bible puts verse 11 in this way. So is my word that goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me unfulfilled, but it will accomplish what I intend and cause to succeed what I sent it to do. The God that we serve is a God whose will be accomplished. And in that, we can take confidence, whether we see his hand or whether his hand is unseen.